Thank you for listening. We're back for another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. With me is Rosie Sumner, who has been sitting in for Laurie Harrison, who has been spending quite a bit of time in France, and we hope to see her again in October. And today we thought it might be a great opportunity to have Rosie tell us about her Lopez experiences, especially when she first came here. And let's begin with asking her the question we all ask each other: how did you get here?
Well, I was living in Snohomish. I had graduated from college and I came up to the Northwest where I thought I belonged, and met my husband, and we had one child, and we were looking for a way to spend more time together as a family, so we were searching for another place to live, and we were considering the Skagit Valley. We were both interested in organic foods, and one day while we were exploring, we got on a ferry, and we only went as far as Orcas, but we picked up a little paper, and we saw a classified ad that said that caretakers were needed for the San Juan County Park on San Juan Island. So we applied for that, very excited about the possibility. I had sailed up in the San Juans as a college student at Reed College on the Adventurous about half a dozen times, and never dreamed that someone like me could actually live in the San Juan Islands. So we went to this interview with some fear and trepidation, and my husband wanted me to, we decided that maybe I would do most of the speaking during the interview because I'm such a blabbermouth, and I agreed that I would do this, but I had a nursing child at the time, and he chose the time that they wanted to interview us to want to nurse, so I left the room. And when I came back, the interview was all done. And my husband was a little flummoxed to have been put on the spot without me, and he did the best he could, but we didn't get the job. So we went home to Snohomish disappointed. But maybe 6 months later, we got a surprise call from the park board telling us that they needed a caretaker on Lopez Island at Odland Park. This was in 1978, and we came up to the island with our baby, and we met Phil Haston, and Donna Kiergaard was her name at that time. Now her name's Donna Graham, and they were two members, the Lopez members of the park board, and we walked around Odland Park and talked about Phil's mother in a nursing home, and Donna was just aghast that I didn't know the difference between a thimbleberry and a salmonberry. And I don't remember really talking much about the job, but pretty soon Phil had to go catch a ferry to go visit his mom. And we said, well, when will you let us know when the interviews are all over and you have picked someone to come take the job? And they said, oh, we need you right away. You can just move in right now. And we had lives, you know, back in Snohomish, but we quickly got it organized and moved up to Lopez on November 11th, 1978, and our little boy was 1 year old on that day, so we moved up on his birthday, and it was very blustery and cold, and I remember the ferry was tiny. It was the little Vashon ferry, and we made several trips with our belongings, and at one of those trips, we used to have purser's on the boat, and the boats weren't always on time, and they would often wait if there was some kind of an emergency. And I remember one time, my husband, somehow the key got stuck in the car door, and I had already gone on the ferry with Andy, the baby, and he wasn't coming, and finally the purser ran up to the parking lot and helped him broke the key off, I think, in the lock, and helped him get on the boat, and the ferry waited for us back in
those
days.
Were the times.
That would never happen now.
No.
So we took care of Odland Park for 4.5 years, And we thought we were in paradise most of that time. It was just an amazing place to be together as a family. And we had another child there. She was born right there in the park cabin. And she lives here now. Her name is Madrona Murphy, and she's 28 years old.
Mm-hmm. And your husband at the time was Kevin Murphy.
Yes, right. And he lives here too with his wife, Mary Hayton, at the Macaulay Farm. And it was a raggedy park when we came there. We inherited quite a job, and Kevin just did a marvelous job of organizing. We had a wonderful old truck back then, an old black pickup truck. It was an antique named Jack, and that's what we used to pick up the garbage. And Kevin did a lot of mowing and a lot of firewood splitting, and people would come right into our house to register. Felt a little like living in a fishbowl. They've since added onto that little cabin, and we had to build a curtain drain around it. It was quite musty and moldy. And we were paid the huge salary of $100 a month. And I remember one thing that Phil said to us when we got the job. In his inimitable style, he said, "You are only going to be earning $100 a month at this job, so you better go get some food stamps." And we took his advice, and we had food stamps and didn't have any shame about it, because we had all the toilet paper roll ends we could possibly use, but you know, we had to make that $100 stretch, and I had a lot of little part-time jobs to help out. So, and Kevin was the one who earned he was the one on the payroll, which was a good thing, because later on, it came in handy that I was not on the payroll. I'll tell you that story in a little bit. Oh, and when we first got here, one of the first things we did was go to the bakery with our little boy, who's having a birthday that day. And Holly had been in business for not very long. I think that was her first year. And we walked in and said, "We just moved here today." And she gave us all free cinnamon rolls.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it was very exciting and a wonderful welcome to Lopez Island for us. Yeah. I was 27 years old when we moved here. And I'll be 59 pretty soon. I've been here all this time. I know this is home.
No doubt about it. So when did you leave Odlin Park?
Well, we left in, 83. Because around that time, some of you may remember that there was a guru named Bhagwan, Sri Rajneesh, who had created a place to be in Oregon, and quite a few Lopezians either went to India or went to Oregon to be with the Bhagwan, he's now known as Osho. He's passed on, but he still has quite a few followers. And some of them lived at the old Macaulay farm, and they sold their shares. And so my husband and I, Kevin and I, were able to purchase one of those shares in 1983 and buy our own little bit of a share on the Macaulay farm and move.
So
there.
How does that work with the Macaulay farm?
Well, everyone owns their own house and house site. But the land, the 40-acre farm, is a land share. It's owned communally. And at this point, I'm not positive because I haven't lived there for a number of years, but I think there's 12 or 13 shares there now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the farmhouse is actually communal.
Yeah, no one actually lives in the farmhouse and hasn't since I've known it. It's used for meetings. There's a kitchen and a wood stove and a phone and a shower outside the farmhouse. It's a historical old Lopez building, though. It's quite something. It has a really nice basement, and some people have their freezers down there and their mm-hmm. canning jars.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Lawrence was one of the caretakers of that farm. I think, who grew up there, Ollie? You interviewed...
Marguerite Goodrow.
Yes.
Yeah, she was a Macaulay, and she grew up on that farm that was first located... Actually, close where Marty's
The Clark family
mm-hmm. lives, and then they decided to move it. Lopez was great about moving buildings. They didn't think anything of it. So the whole farm was moved. I think it was easier in those days since the foundation was just rocks as a rule. And so the building was moved there, and she talked about that because she was a child when that happened.
Yeah. Well, there's a bunkhouse there, and I know when we tore the walls down, well, we went into the walls a little bit to put some soundproofing up when Mama Tamba needed to soundproof the bunkhouse to practice in at one point. And there were all kinds of little notes in there that I always wondered about. Things about very mundane little notes about canning and recipes that someone had just scribbled on the walls. And I have no idea how old those were, but I imagine that some housewife, you know, for lack of paper, was, you know, talking about how much sugar she needed in in her canning operation.
Right, and could look at it again the next day.
Yeah, right there. Yeah. Yeah. That was a great place to live. I still love going back to Macaulay Farm and wandering around. And I'm really pleased that at this point, part of the back pasture where Kevin and I lived with the kids is being used, you know, as a farm. There's goats and horses back there that Jean and Terry have. And it's really nice. And there are beautiful gardens. Doreen Kana lives back there, and she's an amazing gardener. So it's really a lovely place to visit. And Madrona got married there. Madrona and her husband, Russell, were married there a couple of years ago and in the orchard. So it's a great place to have raised a family. Our third child was born there on the farm.
Kiba,
yes. And he's now engaged to another Lopezian, April Holland, who did a lot of growing up here as well. They're back in Cambridge, Massachusetts right now, while April goes to MIT. But Lopez is such a wonderful place to raise children. And even if they leave, I think it's been such a blessing to be able to give them the gift of Lopez to always come back to.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Lopezian children who left here keep in contact with each other. I was totally surprised about the ones who now no longer live in New York, but a group of them lived in New York, and they would meet regularly. Yeah, and help each other, whatever problems there were.
Right.
With living or, you know, jobs or whatever.
Food. Mm-hmm. I know Kiba was living in New York City for a while, and he told me he went to what he thought was a potluck. And people did bring food, but he was the only person in a big group of people who brought something that he had made. Everything else was store-bought. Yeah, that's not the Lopez way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, what community is, because obviously, well, from my perspective, Lopez has changed a great deal. I've been here 30 years from the time I first came. There were fewer people, for one thing. And, you know, it has changed, but I think I've tried to define in my mind what community means and what keeps me here. I've been through some great, wonderful times here and some really difficult times when I felt perhaps I should go. You know, economic problems, emotional difficult times, and I wondered if I should stay on Lopez. But Madrona, my daughter, talks about her definition of community, and she feels, and I agree with her, that community, especially here on an island where we actually have that boundary of water around us to define it, community isn't something that we choose. It sort of chooses us, and we're here, and we deal with each other, even and especially because we are so diverse. There are many different mindsets on this island, and there are different economic classes. There aren't a lot of different races per se, but we're working on that by having so many wonderful adopted children on the island of different races. And I think that to Lopez's credit, we do pretty darn well helping each other out when it's needed, despite different differences of opinion, different political views, different economic situations. I'm really proud to be a member of the Lopez community, and I have felt so. When I was a kid, we moved a lot. My dad, who lives here now on Lopez too, at Hamlet House, he was a city manager, and so we moved and moved and moved a lot in Southern California, Middle California, as he moved around from city to city through his career. And it has given me great joy to live in the same place for 30 years, even though I've changed houses and lived on the north end and in the middle and now reside on the south end. It's still Lopez, and I purchased a place for my ashes to abide in the cemetery, and this is where I live. And I think that people who do find their place here are drawn here for whatever reason, and I don't know what the commonality is. It could just be the love of the beauty of Lopez and the fact that it's a little quieter lifestyle than the city. We'd like to keep it that way. Hopefully we can.
I remember when we moved here permanently, we had bought the land in 71, but it was not until 82 that we came full time. And our friends in California said, "You're too old to move. You'll never make friends." And both of us were 58, and we had no problem making friends. And that was such a surprise to our friends who had, you know, said disaster was going to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we became members of the co-op, and we became members of Islanders for Nuclear Arms Control.
Mm-hmm.
And that took care of it. We mm-hmm. got to know people.
I remember when I met you, you were having car trouble right up at the top of the hill next to the entrance to Odland Park.
Right.
And it was really fun to go and see your house and meet Oscar and help you out by giving you a ride home. We've been friends ever since.
That's right.
And that was in 82 or 83.
I just walked over to the park and asked, could I make a phone call? And you immediately said, "What happened? Do you need help?" And
uh-huh.
And you drove me back to our place.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember one day I was driving up the hill by the library, and I had Madrona and Andy, two tiny kids, in the back seat, and they were fighting. And I turned around to tell them to cut it out, and I immediately went into the ditch. And Dwight Lewis was behind me. And he lived near Odland Park, and I didn't know about Dwight. You know, I hadn't really met him, but I had heard some rumors about him, and I didn't know if we'd get along or not. And Dwight was right there for me, pulled us out in no time at all. And I just thought, wow, mm-hmm. this is the way it's supposed to be.
Right.
And I remember, oh gosh, about 5 years ago, I asked Dwight if he could dump some gravel on my driveway in the south end, and he came down, and in the old days, Dwight would have showed up at 6 a.m. to deliver your gravel. This was more like 9, and he said, "You know, I'm slowing down a little bit here," and he said, "Where are the kids?" or something to that effect, and I said, "Well, Dwight, they're grown up now," and he got a little tear in his eye, and he said, "I remember when your kids were the biggest rascals, and I'd see them, you know, in the park," and yeah, it's just so great to have that longevity with people.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Very true.
Oh, well, let's get back to Islanders for Nuclear Arms Control, because that's one of the first things that I got involved with, too, when I came here. And, boy, I don't know. It was within the first year or two. And in Snohomish, I had been pretty active with our anti-nuclear group. And so I was looking around. I was a, you know, pretty radical idealist in those days, a young whippersnapper. And I found out that some people were protesting the Trident submarines and the nuclear subs that were coming into the Bangor base here too. And I asked what was going on, and ended up going for some nonviolent training over at the Bangor base with Greg Blomberg and Stephen Rubleski and Mark Minkler. And I had to take Andy because he was little and still nursing. So the five of us studied how we could peacefully demonstrate in the base. I'm blanking out on his last name. Sandy and Rhea are going to kill me. His name is Jim. And he's written wonderful books. And he and his wife lived right there by the base and did this training, and we stayed with them. And so early one morning, we hopped over this low fence onto the base with big placards that we'd made in protest of these subs. And I remember it was pretty funny because for a long time, we couldn't find anyone to arrest us. That was the goal, to get arrested. Many people had been arrested trespassing onto the base, and we wanted to do it peacefully, but we definitely wanted to be found. And took us a good hour because it was very early in the morning. And we finally walked right in to the big hangar where the submarines would come in to get outfitted. Huge thing. If you're flying, you know, from the islands down to Seattle, you go over the Bangor base and you see this enormous building. And we walked in there, and some poor guy who was reporting for work around 7 in the morning looked down and saw us, and here we were shaking our sign saying no nukes or whatever it was that we had made. And he said, "Oh, what are you guys doing here?" And he called the guards, and we peacefully waited for them to come get us. And I remember they were so nice, you know. They said, "Well, would you like to sit in the front or the back with your baby?" And on the way to the guardhouse where they arrested us, they gave us a little tour and showed us the old ancient rhododendrons. It's a beautiful base. And then we had to wait all day and, you know, be processed, and they told us to stay in one room, and Andy kept running out into the hallway, as, you know, 1.5-year-olds are wont to do, and I had to chase him and bring him back. And that was the hardest part, was just waiting for, you know, them to process us. It took hours and hours. And during that time, there were other Lopezians outside supporting our action. Sand Dalton was there, and M.A. Nassoy, I remember. And when we finally got released and came home to the island, you know, I was just as high as a kite. And I didn't get it about maybe some people not thinking that what I had done was a good thing. And I remember walking into the grocery store, and a fellow Lopezian was in there. And she said, "Did you hear that some Lopez Islanders got arrested down at the Trident sub base?" And I proudly puffed my chest up and said, "Yeah, I was one of them." And she looked at me aghast and said, how could you do such a thing? Why would you do that?" And I was so surprised and shocked that she wouldn't just agree with my actions. And it was one of my first lessons about community being, you know, diverse, and how we need to accept each other's differences of opinion and just learn to respect each other. And it's okay to argue or debate about it, but not okay to condemn, not okay to just accept.
Didn't somebody say something funny about you living in Odland Park?
Yeah.
What was that again?
Oh, he was laughing at me. You know, I don't know whether he approved of my actions or not, but he said, "You know, you're probably the only peacenik who has a cannon in their front yard." And, you know, the cannon's still there at Odland. I know a few years ago they tried to give it away, and they took it apart. And I was upset. I really liked that cannon, and some people didn't. But, you know, it's a part of history, and it's a reminder to us of that we don't really want to be using cannons anymore. Kids used to play all over it and paint flowers on it, and I'm glad it's still there. One day, when we were taking care of the park, a man came, and he had been in the war, and he had had to haul a cannon like that over some hard terrain. And he looked at that cannon, and he was extremely moved. And I'm really glad that it's still there and that it wasn't taken away. I think they used to fire it before my time. They used to fire something out of it on the 4th of July. Glad that doesn't happen anymore.
Would make a lot of noise.
Yes, it would. So, and I think Islanders for Nuclear Arms Control, I don't know, Ollie, do you remember when it...
I have no idea. I know it existed when we came.
I remember Steve Adams was working at the school, and he... One of the other things we did is we went to protest the first Trident sub coming in to Hood Canal, to the base. A whole lot of people from all over the place went, and they stalled, actually bringing the sub in to try to outwait us. And I remember going there and waiting for it. And Steve Adams, in his tech class, had a bunch of kids help him build a lot of boats, little boats, for part of that protest. And I think it was pretty controversial. It was something that he got in trouble for at the time. But they were nice little boats, and they worked pretty well. And a lot of community people helped build them. We took them over there, and I remember I had to come back home at one point and go to work. I was working at Holly B's because it was taking so darn long for that sub to come in so that we could, you know, row out there and wave our little placards at this huge thing coming through. But then we went back, and I was there when it happened. Greenpeace was involved, and it was an amazing thing to be involved with that.
Long time ago.
Yeah, it was. Still.
When nuclear things were still...
Well, and San Juan County declared itself a nuclear-free zone.
Oh, right. Yes, they did.
I don't remember when
that
was.
You were very proud of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was about the time... When I first moved here, you know, there was a little land rush... in the mid-70s, late-70s, when a lot of young people were able to buy land on Lopez. I know Steve Horn and Stanley Greenthal purchased their land during that time. And there was a wonderful man named Hugh Lawrence, who has since passed. But some of you remember Huey. He was very involved in theater. And he and Laura Sewell bought some land... just off of School Road. Sue DeMond, on one of these shows a couple of months back, talked about living in Outer Hooterville. And Hugh Lawrence is someone I met before I ever moved to Lopez. He was hitchhiking home from having been on some travels, and one of my housemates in Snohomish picked him up hitchhiking, and he crashed at our house for the night before going on to the ferry. And the next day I needed to go up to Burlington because I was studying childbirth education. I wanted to teach it. And he needed a ride. So he and I went up to the ferry dock. And on the way he told me about his place on Lopez and sounded pretty fascinating. I didn't know at the time that I'd be moving there within a year. So when I got to the island, I went and visited him and said, "Do you remember me, you know?" And so he became one of my first friends here. But I always thought it was pretty great that when he moved to where he lived on Hooterville Road, he called that area Hooterville. He bought some land there with his friend Laura Sewell. And they called it Hooterville sort of after Hooverville because nobody had very much money. And most of them didn't have regular phones for a while. And so they just hoot at each other. And so it became Hooterville because there were lots of hoot, hoot, hoots going on in the woods there when they wanted to contact their neighbors.
Beautiful. I never knew where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a Hugh Lawrence invention. And Lisa Geddes, who is his widow and wonderful friend of mine, lives there still in the heart of Hooterville, which I think is a magical place on this island, one of many.
That's right.
So, and speaking of Lisa and magic, there was a time when I was living at Macaulay Farm when quite a few people got interested in marimba music, and there was one marimba band, and then that kind of broke apart, and then some intrepid women decided to start another one. And it wasn't supposed to be all women, or it didn't necessarily need to be, but it ended up being all women. And M.A. Nasoy, who lived at the farm, pretty much headed it up, and it turned into a group called Mama Tamba, and we are still perfectly willing to come out and sing for events.
And still do.
We recently, I wasn't there because I was on a trip out of the country, but we recently sang at David Fisher's memorial. That was a wonderful group and a wonderful therapy for all of us to get together every Monday night at the bunkhouse at the farm there and play marimbas and sing. And we did that for about 17 years.
17 years.
I think so. It was a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't meet regularly now, but there's something forged when you do something like that that makes you sisters for life.
Right. And you still get together when you feel it's needed the community.
Yeah. Or for each other.
For each other, mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah, and another way that the community has changed, but we've managed to survive, is in the way that we get together for important events. The Long Dance was started long ago, over 20 years ago, and it was always held at the Longhouse out at Camp Norwester. So when Camp Norwester moved, it was difficult, but people persevered, and we still celebrate winter solstice in a very similar way by having a long dance. And when people are going to have a baby or when someone passes away, we have similar gatherings. I remember when Margaret DeVoe, who was a good friend of mine, had a bookstore in the tower in town that just got beautifully
redone,
reshingled by Ron Norman this summer. The chamber paid for that. Margaret used to have a bookstore there and used to have a bike shop here. She passed away rather quickly, and boy, people needed to meet. Mm-hmm. And that's something I've always so loved about Lopez, is people just started calling each other and saying, we need to meet, even before there's a formal memorial. We just need to get together to talk about Margaret and to wish her off. And we all just met down at Wattmau and that night, and her son was there, Nick, and we sang and we talked and we cried and we ate and we laughed and we told stories and held each other and stood in a circle and honored her. And that has happened so many times, countless times, and it's happening now. People meet and sing or walk the labyrinth that Nick and Susie have made for people who need it, because we need to remember each other and to be outside together when we're saying goodbye. And birthing circles happen too, and lovely showers for the new ones.
And also the coming of age. I think that's mm-hmm. a beautiful, fairly new of the last 20 years or so.
Well, let's see. How old is Cedar Bough? She's in her 30s. Andy's, my son's 31. They had them, but you're right. They had to have been in their teens for that to have happened. Now, Cedar Bough's wasn't, she chose, I think, to go shopping in Seattle with her women friends and didn't do, what some of the kids here do. But every young person sort of gets to choose what they want to do, and the community supports them.
Right. Yeah, very lovely.
And it's not too late. Madrona and Andy both did that. Kiba hasn't chosen to do that. But if someone in the community needs something like that, they just have to be brave enough to say so.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be done.
Right.
I remember a woman who used to live here named Annie. again, I'm blanking out on her last name. And she decided to have a ceremony just to honor herself. She didn't think she was ever going to get married. She did get married right after that. But she had this wonderful ceremony where she sort of married herself. And I heard about it, and I just thought it was delightful, you know. Or if someone is feeling the need, they can just sort of call a circle. And people who have time and energy will show up. And you get to create it. You get to create a community event that you need. These community events have gotten a lot bigger than they used to be. I mean, now we have giant community memorials and birthday parties and weddings at the community center, which we certainly didn't have the community center when I was first here. We had the Legion Hall, and we had the Grange, and we had, I remember, some wonderful Halloween parties at McKay Harbor Inn when it was being lived in by other folks and wasn't being used so much as a bed and breakfast. And those were marvelous times. Stanley would play music, and Halloween, everyone would go all out to dress up in crazy wild costumes. And that still happens, but it's bigger. In those days, it was maybe 20 of us the most, and that was a huge party. And I remember, too, when we came to the island, we were vegetarian. But that couldn't last, because we'd go to a potluck, and Andy would just be grabbing the meat off the table because it was so good. And sometimes there'd be venison and salmon and just these wonderful dishes with meat in them. And I remember I was teaching childbirth classes to some folks from Shaw when we were living at Odlin, and they wanted to trade for some meat. And so they gave me a choice, and I said to Kevin, well, what would you like? Would you like some rabbit or some elk? And Kevin was a vegetarian when I met him, and he said, better go for the elk. And when he said that, I knew our vegetarian days were over. Yeah.
Well, I was remembering today that the Shakespeare rehearsals take place in what we used to call Natalie's Barn.
Uh-huh.
And of course, at one time, that's where some of the concerts took place.
Yeah. Did some of the LaPorte concerts take place in there?
I don't know for sure whether it was the LaPorte concerts, but there were concerts there. There were big parties there,
mm-hmm.
you know, all kinds of things that, you know, fitted in.
Yeah.
But as you said, as the community grew, it was almost too full, you know.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. But very lovely, I remember.
Uh-huh. And I know I Paul Hayward built that barn.
Right.
I remember that. He's told me stories about building it and collaborating with Natalie on what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful barn. Got some gorgeous places here. And it's really great that places like, I mean, I got involved with theater very early on, too, because I went to, I graduated in theater arts in college, but I felt like, oh my gosh, now I've got to do more. I'm out of college and I have to figure out a way to do more theater. And that was one of my hesitations about moving to Lopez, because I thought, how am I going to do any drama here? It's just such a tiny community. Where would we do it? But we managed. There was a huge production right before I moved here called The Island of Zipol. And White Bear was very involved in that. I think she was the director. And people obviously had just a fantastic time, and almost everyone in the community had something to do with it. And so right after I moved here, White Bear, whose name was Connie Martin then, did another one. And it was called, it had a long title. It was called What If They Gave a Party and Everybody Came? And there were probably 50 people in the cast, or between 30 and 40 at least. I mean, there were so many people on stage, lots of kids. I remember Jeremy Ward, who's going to have a family soon here, and he must be in his late 30s, was in that play, and he was a little boy, a little dog running around. Was he a dog? What was he? I can't remember now. anyway, all these kids who are now all grown up were in it, and there was some wonderful costuming. Pamela Meriton, who has been doing costuming for us forever, was involved in that too. And there was a whole forest of people being trees, and there were all these people who were being butterflies, and it was this phantasmagoria of incredible costumes and scenery and lights and just incredible. I was blown away by what this small community could pull together just for fun.
And that was done at what is now Woodman Hall?
Yep, they've been doing it ever since. Yeah, and the light booth was this funny little box stuck onto the side of the building that they just got rid of recently in the renovation there. It was pretty rickety. You had to go outside and climb up a little ladder to get in there. I've been in a lot of places in the Legion Hall, Woodman Hall, and I hope that I'll be in a couple more in there in the future, because it's historic old theater as well as being all kinds of other things.
Right.
Yeah. Done a lot of things there backstage. And I think the pumpkin carving, I mean, I'll never forget. I'm sure a lot of people here won't forget the sight of Woodman Hall all lit up near Halloween with all the whole place smelling like pumpkin, and 50 to 100 pumpkins up there all lit up and glowing, and all the crazy faces while someone tells some kind of scary story and the kids are all cuddled down all over the building. It's a wonderful thing. I remember doing a dance recital there that MA put on, and we put up all these pieces of scenery made out of flats all over the place, and the audience sort of had to sit on the stage and watch this very modern dance thing happening down below with all these pieces of scenery. That was ages and ages ago.
And the tap dancing still has its annual performance there.
I think they've done it at the community center.
Oh, the last time,
few years.
Because they were having too many people come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
well, I think that's the beauty that we have different buildings for different size events.
Yeah. Well, they practice at the Grange a lot. The tap dancers do.
Yeah.
So what else? Oh, you know, I think it's funny the rumors that happen around here. And I mean, if I had had, I've had three kids, but if I had been pregnant as many times as it was rumored that I was, I would have 10 kids. People are always asking me if I was pregnant in the old days. Oh, I have a funny story about when I was pregnant with Madrona. My friend Lori Tycro came to visit me one day, and she asked me what I was going to name my baby. And I told her that the name that I had for a girl was Madrona. Beautiful Madrona trees at the park. And she was pregnant too. She was a couple months behind me. And it wasn't until years later that she finally confessed to me that that was what she wanted to name her little girl, if she had a girl. But when I told her I was going to name my daughter Madrona if I had a girl, in those days we didn't know what gender we were going to have till it happened, she said it was fine for her to switch, but it was just so gracious of her to just not say, oh, that was a name I was going to choose, and for us to sort of try and decide, well, should we have two Madronas or what should we do? But she named her daughter Hannah Rose, which is also a beautiful name. And so many plant names on the island and tree names that we have here. Cedar bough and cedar and aspen and, oh, help me think of some others. There's so many. Wren, little Rosa Wren, and there's
a lot of
tree names. Yep. Very and
nice.
Flower names, lupin. Yep. Yep. Lots of beautiful children grow up here. It's so wonderful to see them be born and then to watch them grow up and go off and have kids of their own. And it's amazing getting older in the same community.
It is. And it's a very different experience.
So fun, you know. You lose your wallet somewhere and somebody picks it up and brings it back to you.
Right.
Yeah. Yay, Lopez.
It's like my grandson, when he was about 10 or 11, he said, "I love Lopez. It's so peaceful," which was a very unusual thing to say for a child.
Yeah. I remember when Kiba went off to college, he went to Philadelphia, to Temple, and Temple's right in the middle of Philadelphia. It's quite noisy there. And he came home. And, you know, I don't know if other people have had this experience, but when your kids leave home, sometimes the last year or 6 months before they go can be pretty difficult. You know, there's quite a bit of unrest and disagreement, and some friend of mine called it fouling the nest before you leave, you know, and they're just ready to go and they're making sure that you know it. So Kiba, you know, went off to college, and we've always had a great relationship, don't get me wrong, but he came home for Christmas and it was, you know, dark and cold and there weren't a lot of people around, but I was so excited to see him and I made him a salad the first night he was home. And he said, "Oh, a salad." And he was so appreciative of fresh greens. And then he went outside and he said, "I just have to listen to how quiet it is here." And he had this whole new appreciation of Lopez because he'd been gone, you know, for months. It was great. Yeah, it's so fun to leave because you can come home.
You can come home again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another rumor was that I gave birth to Kiba on the kitchen floor in my house at Macaulay Farm. I did have a home birth, and it was a wonderful event, but there was a rug. I just want to make that quite clear. I was quite comfortable, and everything went very smoothly, and there was this huge full moon. It was in late January, and right before I gave birth, I was out taking a walk, and there were these little birds flying in the bushes and in the trees, making all this noise in the middle of the night, just chirping away. And then the moon came out, and it was just magical.
Perfect.
It was amazing. And he was my third child, so by that time I kind of knew how to do it, and it was really a pleasure. You know, some people try to get off-island to have their babies. I remember I was just terrified of being off-island and not making it home to have mine.
Yeah, most of the women who were living on Lopez early on, they went off island. They went to Anacortes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very grateful to have had two home births on Lopez Island. Those kids really know they belong here.
Right.
No matter where they might go. Madrona always knew she wanted to come back after she finished college. And she's here. Doing good work.
Yeah, that's very special.
Yeah. I saw a sign yesterday. I took my dad, who I mentioned lives here now, over to the Spit by Fisherman Bay Peninsula, and I saw a little sign about Island Marbled Butterfly Habitat. I said, "Look at that, Grandpa. You can bet your granddaughter had something to do with that
most
sign
likely
being there."
Right.
Yep. Yeah, so what else shall we talk about?
Well, did you want to mention Jeff Ewens?
Yeah, that would be a lovely thing to do. Jeff was a fine, upstanding citizen of Lopez Island for many years. Ollie and I were trying to remember when he moved here. And you moved here in 1982, correct? And Jeff was already here.
Was here.
I remember my friend Laura Sewell, who doesn't live here anymore, but who I mentioned purchased the land with Hugh Lawrence in the heart of Hooterville. She had gone to school with Jeff back in Rhode Island, I believe at the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD. And he was sharing a shop with David Bill in Seattle, and a carpentry shop, cabinetry carpentry shop. And he wanted... The Bills had invited him up here. Sandy and Sally Bill still are to me one of the first families of Lopez, as I knew Lopez. And I know I'm not an old timer, but in those days, they were, you know, if you got to go to a Christmas Eve party at Sandy and Sally Bill's, boy, it was something. And they invited a lot of people, and it was just so beautiful. And they had a Christmas tree with real candles
right.
lit on the tree. And the kids would usually put on a puppet show for us in one of the bedrooms, and we'd all crowd in there to watch. My kids really got into that every year. So anyway, Jeff was sort of an extended member of the Bill family, and he came up here, and Laura said, "Hey, Rosie, I can't remember what the situation was exactly, but this was way back in 82, and she said, I need to help my friend Jeff move up to Lopez, and I've got the pickup truck, and I had some errand to run too, so I went with her. So I met Jeff the day that he moved to Lopez, and I remember Laura and I were having some feminist argument or debate in the front seat and sort of talking about, you know, women's rights and darn those men anyway, and Jeff was being very quiet, and at one point Laura asked him what he thought of this conversation, and he said that he pretty much agreed with everything we were saying, and I thought, oh, I like this guy. And yeah, we were good friends for many years. And he became extremely involved in the community. And you can help me with this. I mean, he helped start the land trust along with Rod Morgan, whom Morgantown is named after. He was on the first board of the land trust. He was on the Friends of the Library.
Oh, yes, for years.
Was that the same? Were you on the Friends also?
I was on the Friends board. I was asked to come in the winter of 83. And I don't think he was on the board at that time, but a few years later he was. And I remember Mary Laporte was on the board, and so was Jeff Hewins.
Ah, yeah. I remember after Jeff passed away, Mary wrote me a note and said something to the effect of, why do the good ones have to go? You know, she was very,
oh, yeah.
very fond of Jeff.
Yes, yes. And he was a calligrapher of absolutely fantastic ability.
Mm-hmm.
He made all the invitations for the library, when the library moved across the street. The invitations were all done by him. And when you look at it, it's absolutely perfect. And he would make drawings of the library.
Yes.
And then later on, this was past the mid-80s, there were the Wednesday at the library events.
Wednesday night at the library.
Yeah.
Every Wednesday night in the winter.
Something was going
something.
On.
Something. People would bring slides from amazing travels.
Right.
Or come and talk about the incredible careers that they had, some of the retired folk.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
And Jeff made a poster for each of these events, and sometimes he spent so much time doing it so perfectly. And I said, it's only for a week, you know, for a weekend,
mm-hmm.
and next week there will be something else. He felt it was important, and he made another poster.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he was a cabinet maker here.
Oh, and a fantastic cabinet maker.
Yeah.
There are beautiful cabinets all over the island
that Jeff made. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he was also on the school board, and he
That's
took
right.
that very seriously, even though he didn't have any children of his own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well...
And politically, he was very much involved with the Democratic Party, and when we had a caucus, everybody looked up to Jeff for kind of guiding the discussion.
Uh-huh.
And he was the one who wrote the platform.
Uh-huh.
And of course it had all kinds of fantastic things in it that all of us wanted every year again.
Like
it,
what? Can you remember anything?
Well, like good relations with Cuba was one of them. I remember that. A lot of them that never made it beyond the county.
Uh-huh.
Or sometimes past the county but never made it to state.
Mm-hmm.
So. But the experience was very good. And a lot of people, you know, who would ask each other, well, who are we going to vote for? Who, you know, what is the most important? We would say, ask Jeff. Because he had done all the studying that you could do and know
right.
all about
yeah.
everybody.
You want to know how to vote, you can
yeah.
talk to
yeah.
to Jeff.
You can get all the information from him.
Yeah.
That was very funny.
Yes, he was a big part of this community, and it's interesting, I mean, the way I can ascertain how much Lopez has changed, I know a lot of folks here, and some of them I feel are very dear friends, and, oh, at least half of them didn't know Jeff.
That's right.
He died in 1994.
Right.
Very suddenly, he had a stroke, and it was such a large one. And they didn't have the technology then that they do now.
Mm-hmm.
And he died within 3 days. He'd been on a fishing trip with his dear friends, Chris and Rita Elliott, up in Canada, and it was a cold, wet trip. And they think perhaps a blood clot got stuck in his leg and came up through his heart. After he died, they discovered he had a hole in his heart that he didn't know he had. And then that blood clot went into a lot of little pieces and into his brain and caused damage. Jeff and I were sweeties at that time and had been for about a year and a half. He was a wonderful stepdad. Took it very seriously. He was a great person.
He was very good with children.
He was. He loved kids.
Yeah.
And I remember Lori Tycro and I one time, but he liked to discipline, you know, he wanted things to be orderly. And I remember one time we were all having a dinner together, Lori and her 5 kids, and myself and my 3 kids, and Jeff, who, you know, could feel a bit overwhelmed by that many children. We'd had our dinner, and there were 2 kinds of ice cream. And Jeff was offering the kids ice cream and asked each one which kind they wanted. And Madrona said, well, I'd like some of both. And he said, oh, no, you have to choose one or the other. And Lori and I looked at him and said, and why is that, Jeff? Couldn't you just give her a smaller portion of each? And he said, oh, well, I guess I could do that. You know? there was a little compromise there. He was very good at compromising.
Right.
He really was. And I remember I worked at the school when he was on the school board, and we had some just horrendous issues sometimes. And I remember realizing how good he was at looking at the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would be terrible being on a board. I don't really enjoy meetings and hashing things out. But I think that one of the qualities you need to be able to do that, and I have great admiration for people who do that work, is that you need to be able to get past the little details and the little debates to look at the bigger goals. What is it we really want to do here? What is for the common good? And he was just really, that was one of his skills.
That's true.
And I think the island lost a lot when they lost Jeff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have a bookcase here in the Lopez Library that was given to the library from Jeff's family and friends. The only thing, it's great to have a little plaque here commemorating him. The only thing is, if he saw it, he would want to rebuild it.
Most likely.
Because it doesn't have all wooden fasteners and, yeah.
It was not quite up to his standards.
No, not quite. But no. He's going to have to forgive us for that one.
Right. Right.
Well, I think we're about to come to the close of our show, and I just want to say what a privilege it's been to be interviewed, and I hope it's been an impetus to some of you to remember why you came to Lopez and why you're still here.
That's right. And Rosie, thank you so much for not only this interview, which I thought was marvelous, because you really gave words to what community is like on Lopez, but also for sitting in for Lori and helping me, since I cannot see the buttons to push. And you know how this technical stuff works. So thank you so much. And thank everybody for listening. And I hope you will be ready the next month for another edition of Once Upon an Island.
Thanks.
Tales from Lopez.
Thanks so much, Ollie. And goodbye, everyone.